This episode of the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top available podcast app around. You can get instant updates of my new podcasts or others that you listen to directly to your app. It's free, easy to use, and gives you all the features you need to help discover new podcasts and even create your own. Whether you use an Android or iPhone device, this app is the podcast app for you. Get the Podbean podcast app now on Google Play or Apple's App Store and start enjoying more from the podcast that you love. Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Now, unlike Gary Lineker, I will not be presenting this show in my underwear. I haven't made any outlandish predictions that have come true quite yet, and I don't have the physique of a sports star. But, give it time. Who knows what will happen in future episodes. This week, we're going to be carrying on a new format from last week, where each of the guests chooses a topic, polling related, to talk about, and then we debate some of the issues around it. So without further ado, let me introduce my guests, Rob Vance, fellow podcaster and from Penshine Berland. Rob, welcome back.
Great to see you, Kim.
And Leo Barassi, who was on last week, of course, from Noise of the Crowd, but also fellow podcaster too. Leo, welcome.
Hi, Kieran.
So, guys, let's see how we get on with this week's show. Leo, you've been looking at some recent polling data from Ipsos Mori's Political Monitor, haven't you?
That's right. So this is the monthly Political Monitor that Mori have recently put out. And there's really just two numbers that I want to talk about from it. The first is Theresa May's net satisfied score. So this is a number of people, or the proportion who are satisfied minus the proportion who are dissatisfied. And that's plus 35. Same for the government, proportion who are satisfied minus proportion who are dissatisfied, minus 3. So there's two ways I think we could look at this. Firstly, we could say, OK, so the government has got a net negative satisfaction there, a new government, they've got not quite a new mandate, but a sort of feeling of a fresh start, big change, lots of new ministers, and already they're coming in as having more people having negative views of them than positive views. Theresa May's very positive score, well, we might say she's an unknown. This is about people projecting what they think onto her, and it's not actually real, and it's going to meet reality. People are going to start falling out of love with her fairly soon. So you could say, well, this kind of suggests they're beatable. The opposition get competent, and things could change. Thing is, though, I don't really think that's right. I think if you look back at what these scores have been like in the past, then you see a bit of a different picture. So the last two prime ministers who've come in midterm, taken over from a predecessor without an election, Brown, at his best, his net satisfaction score was only plus 20, and his government's net satisfaction score was minus 17 at its best. So a long way behind where May's come in on. Those are all Mori's numbers, by the way. Right. The other, and I think actually this is really the relevant parallel, is Major. And May's government really looks a lot more like Major's government in terms of its popularity than anyone else's. So January 1991, Major's government had a net favourability of minus 8. He personally had a favourability of plus 46. Pretty similar scores to May's. And He was taken on by a reasonably competent soft-left government and was still able to win. Now, if I was Labour, I'd be looking at that and being quite worried.
Rob, what do you make of some of these numbers? Because this is a polling question that Ipsos Mori have tracked over a long period of time, as Leo alluded to. Satisfaction with the job that different leaders are doing. I mean, before we even go into the nuts and bolts of it, what do you make of that question?
Well, I think it's significant that the leader tends to outstrip the government in terms of its popularity. And I think there's all sorts of reasons that you could go into for why that might be. But it is a reminder that fundamentally we do have an increasingly personalised, government, right? It's, the power of the executive in Theresa May is what people are really looking at. People are conscious that perhaps the government itself actually hasn't changed that much, but the leadership has, right? I don't know what Cameron's versus the government's numbers were previously, but I imagine that he's had a fairly healthy lead over the government for a fairly sustained period of time as well.
Yeah, I think that's the case, and the government's satisfaction score has come up with May taking over.
Interesting. So maybe there is some sense of a bit of a turn and change. But I would imagine if you ask voters if they were satisfied with Theresa May's job as Home Secretary, I suspect that her satisfaction numbers would be significantly lower.
Well, there'd probably be a lot of don't knows as well, right? I mean, this is sort of the thing about her, that she gives a good image, but you ask people what she stands for, and I suspect people would generally struggle.
I certainly think, I mean, Rick Mike was writing on political betting earlier today about this, that there's a certain intangible element to how people judge politicians, brands, whatever it might be, that kind of emotional connection people talk about. And I think there's something about Theresa May which you can't quite put your finger on, that just exudes confidence, authority, you know, and I think that seems to have naturally come through in some of her numbers. I mean, 54% satisfied with the job she's doing. I mean, you know, other than say Brexit means Brexit, you could argue what has she actually tangibly done other than handle maybe transition quite
well. Coolly dispatching Boris Johnson, Michael Gove and Andrea Leadsom in the space of about a week is quite an impressive sort of hatchet job, right?
Mm. Although, from most people's perspective, she did that by standing still and letting them knock themselves out more than anything.
But I think there's a certain degree to which that kind of calm, detached maturity is possibly what people are looking for.
Well, yeah, I mean, just I suppose the point is of kind of the competence thing, and here's someone who can take charge. I mean, I went over Brown's numbers pretty quickly, but a plus 20 satisfaction score when he first came in isn't bad. Mm. I mean, most modern political leaders would be pretty delighted with that score.
But he'd sent back the floods at this point, right? And all.
Maybe this was about the time that this was happening, but this is sort of the first set of numbers, first couple of months, I think it was, that he had. So you're right, maybe that was part of it. But I suppose the point is, it's not that hard for a Prime Minister to come in, make some good speeches, not have made any major decisions, and generally look competent. Mm. I think I agree that May is perhaps slightly better than average in terms of coming in and looking fairly competent, but I suppose you could also say this is something that unravels with the wrong decisions.
I suppose the other point you've got to make is that these things can't be seen in isolation. Her perceived competence or satisfaction rating is probably related to perceptions of the opposition. And I think we see that in some Labour Party numbers, which we're going to bring up on the screen for those watching, which I'll talk about for those listening. And one of the observations we've seen from Ipsos, Murray's political monitor, but from other data, is this kind of declining satisfaction with Jeremy Corbyn amongst Labour voters. Now, this is obviously a different group of people than Labour Party members, who most expect will re-elect Jeremy Corbyn in a month or so's time. I understand there is a YouGov poll out this weekend of the members, so we'll see what happens there. But we've seen a gradual declining sort of rating for Jeremy Corbyn. And also, there's a striking finding from Ipsos Mori's Political Monitor this week that shows that Labour voters are more satisfied with the job that Theresa May's doing than the job that Jeremy Corbyn's doing. And one of the things I just wonder is, leaving aside, you know, the nuance of that finding and how much you trust it, I just wonder whether Theresa May, by not being Jeremy Corbyn, or the Labour, and by the Tories, by not being Labour, helps them as much as their own perceived competence. So what do you think about some of that? I mean, Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these things, it's almost like a protest, right? And I think it's interesting that Labour voters are willing to say that they're satisfied with Theresa May having not done anything bad, but are not willing to give the same kind of rating to the, as it were, a Conservative government. And I think that speaks volumes. The fact that there's a net, you know, that they're more happy with Theresa May than Jeremy Corbyn speaks to how divided, you know, the support, you know, the Labour Party's base is. But I kind of question what that really means. I mean, being satisfied and dissatisfied, ultimately the question is, are you going to vote for the Labour Party at the next election? To which, you know, the numbers aren't going to be wildly different. From this, you know.
Presumably,
by definition, these Labour supporters are people who've said that they're going to vote Labour at the next election.
Right, so these are people who say they're going to vote Labour at the next election rather than 2015 supporters,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess we're assuming. So
the question becomes,
and something has to change, right?
Yeah, the question becomes, does that mean the Tories have further to grow? And I think, bear in mind, on the Ipsos Mori Political Monitor, the Tories are on 45, which was huge. I mean, Labour were on, I think, 34 or 36. Both major parties looked quite high, in my opinion. But you could argue that there's space for them to grow. You could also argue this is temporary. And actually, once there is a permanent leader,
I mean, Theresa May has the most challenging inbox of any incoming Prime Minister in a pretty long time, if you ask me.
You shouldn't forget that. You know, the Brexit means Brexit. What does Brexit mean?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where as soon as you start adding colour to it, you start losing people, right? Mm. I'm not convinced that there's much headroom in terms of, if you like, Brexit supporters who are suddenly going to come round to Theresa May's point of view over the coming weeks, whereas I think there's a significant number of them who may well get dissatisfied.
What about Labour supporters who voted Leave? One would imagine that would arguably be people the Conservative Party ought to be trying to target. if there is such a disconnect?
I think it's hard for the Conservative Party with a capital C to start going after those voters. I think there was an interesting piece in the New Statesman today, which is very much about, you know, what it culturally means to be a Labour supporter, and, you know, the kind of, you know, and Danny Finkelstein's piece in the Times about the challenges of forming the SDP and the tension between a kind of, you know, that in a sense opposition to Corbyn has two kinds within the Labour Party itself. You've got a kind of liberal bunch and you've got a kind of more northern SDP type bunch. You know, one comes at it from the question of, you know, that could form a kind of liberal London based party, of a sort of radical party, and one that could form a kind of northern small C conservative, but, you know, strong on defence, pro-union, pro-public sector jobs. You know, they're two very different kinds of groups of people. And fundamentally, I don't see either one of those being particularly winnable, if you like, for Theresa May, not least in terms of the North. I mean, the more and more people start comparing her to the Iron Lady, the less and less likely a traditional, despite being post-union, if you like, but less and less likely that those kind of communities that are still, you know, essentially, whether you can agree or disagree about the economics, but essentially still feel scarred by the 80s experience of Thatcherism, I think it's less and less likely that they're there for the picking.
Well, let's hold that thought on the UK for the moment. We'll come back to that later in the show. But Rob, for your topic, you were looking at events across the pond and some recent work by 538, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the... So this starts from the stylized fact that nobody in the last 50, whatever it is, 55, 60 years has had a lead coming out of the convention. Once it's settled down a little bit, has come out with a lead in the convention and then gone on to lose the popular vote. The popular vote is important in this because those of you are familiar with the numbers will know that Al Gore, of course, won the popular vote in 2000 despite losing the Electoral College to Bush. But I think, you know, it starts out from that premise of saying, so is Hillary, then is Hillary therefore inevitably going to win? And I mean, I think essentially what the argument that it's making is it's not all over yet. Whilst the probability, as this says, you know, is, you know, pretty high. You know, 78, we've seen it above 80 in the last week, and depending on
so
the...
So what is this probability? So I know 538 have a couple of different models, don't they?
Yeah.
So the one we've got on screen here has 78% chance of Hillary Clinton being president. But what does that actually mean?
So I believe, I don't know the full mechanics off by heart, but I believe what they do is they use the polling data and also other data like regression towards the mean, so the tendency of states to go back to the kind of closer to the vote last time round to this time, economic data on jobs, manufacturing output and so on. They use all of that data to in a sense run probabilistic models for each and every state. So, you know, if you've got a big polling lead in the state and, you know, the jobs numbers are good in that state, then the chances are that the incumbent last time will win and so on. And they run those things over and over and over again. And if you run these thousands and thousands of times, you come up with the probability of, you know, the certain different outcomes happening. So therefore, you're able to come up with, like, you know, what's the probability of a tie in the Electoral College? And that's because it happens three times out of 30,000 simulations or whatever.
And just to be clear, they have three models, as I understand it, on their website. So they have what would happen if there was an election tomorrow, which at the moment is overwhelmingly Clinton. Model where they only take into account the polls and don't think about economic data, and then the one that we're talking about at the moment, which is the one with the polls and also take into account things like jobs.
So in this piece that Rob references, which was by Harry Ensign at 538, there was a grid in there which looked at you know, the difference between the polling essentially after the conventions and the actual eventual result. And we've got that on screen here, which we'll share it on social media later. But there's a few that sort of jumped out at me. I mean, the last election in 2012, President Obama, the polls between the post-convention and what ended up happening didn't really move. I mean, Rob, would you say there's any that, if we look back in history, any sort of case studies that maybe Hillary Clinton should be worried about?
Well, I think the ones that she...
You mentioned George Bush, of course, but I mean...
Yeah, so I think... Well, I think Bush being able... I think the... So 2000 is an interesting example. Al Gore going out of the convention had a 5.5% lead. I think it's fair to say that despite being the son of a former president, George Bush wasn't necessarily that well-known, whereas Al Gore had been around for, you know, 8 years on everybody's screens. And so, in effect, the don't-knows moved towards George Bush over the course of that election. Famously, Al Gore didn't use Bill Clinton to campaign for him, and various other campaigning sort of, I would argue, errors, which meant that Bush was able to squeak through, you know, with hanging chads in Florida and the rest. So I think that's a certain warning, but I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump, without wanting to sound too sort of superstitious, Donald Trump is not you know, in the same position as George W. Bush. Donald Trump is far better known. You know, his opinion on issues is far better known than Bush. Bush was managed to run a campaign as a bit of a blank slate. People were able to project all sorts of things onto him. He was kind of reasonable. He was kind of unassuming. He was, you know, quite
like a passionate conservative, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, but you know, he had huge amounts of institutional support. He had pots of money. He had a brilliant organisation and an electoral strategist in Karl Rove, the likes of which the Republican Party certainly hadn't seen for 30 years. And you know, take all that together, and you know, he was running a phenomenal campaign, you know, and the other side weren't using their greatest electoral asset in history, basically. Mm. So I think it's fair to say that that might not be the best comparator, but it does show that, you know, that's a fairly big jump. And, of course, was the last time that you had the Democrats going for a third presidential election in a row. So a bit of a warning there. I think the one that the article pulls out as being interesting is 1968, where, you know, 68 was a chaotic time. Anybody who's read Nixonland, a fantastic book, will, you know all about, you know, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the party split between, you know, the Students for a Democratic Society side of stuff, anti-Vietnam War and the establishment. Hubert Humphrey as the incumbent vice president, massively unpopular, but actually after literally a bloody convention with, you know, people being tear gassed in the street and shot at in Chicago, able to actually unify the party's wings, both left and right, and put in a pretty creditable performance to take Nixon really, really close in 1968. And, of course, that was the third election that the Democrats were going for to win. So, if anything, you know, that suggests that, you know, I think to an extent, you know, Hillary's been able to unify the party to a greater extent than people thought possible in a very, very short space of time. The number of articles being written about, you know, holdouts, you know, Bernie supporters for Trump and so on, it's kind of almost disappeared. And so, you know, a lot of that kind of momentum has kind of unwound, and it's unwound in Hillary's favour. And if anything, it's now the stories are much more about Republicans. I think there was a recent guy who's come out as like an independent Republicans against Trump who's, you know, trying to get on the ballot. And there's a hell of a lot more discussion about disunity on the Republican side than the Democratic side, and that's only to the benefit of Hillary.
Yeah, I suppose, Leah, there's a couple of months left, but I mean, nothing's inevitable in politics, but I mean, the balance of probabilities, as 538 say, seem overwhelmingly in favour of Hillary Clinton becoming president, don't they?
Well, it's sort of, I think it's one of those weird times where you need to make a judgment call about whether you're going to be led by the data and the models, or whether you need to apply your own analysis. And I think what 538 were doing with that article, and are doing generally with their models, is trying to stick really quite rigorously to the data and the historical evidence. So the point of what they were saying was, look, Clinton is 7-8 points up. That is more than has ever been overcome, but only just. I mean, the 68 one Rob was talking about, the move between the convention and the election was just over 7 points. So what 538 is saying is, look, if you look historically, then actually it wouldn't be totally unprecedented for this to change. But I do think that this is one of those rare occasions where it is probably really worth taking a step back from the long-term trends and the models and saying, look, we need to think about this just in the context of what's going on at the moment. And to change an 8-point lead, you would think that Trump would need to do something very different from what he's been doing. I mean, it seems fairly clear that so far things haven't been working for him, that there's a general long-term drift away from him. But the evidence is he's not doing that. He doesn't see that. It seems that actually he's unleashing a kind of let Trump be Trump sort of campaign. And, you know, I think we have to factor that in as well as looking at these models.
I'm always very sceptical of any left or right campaign when they say let X be X. I mean, it works on the TV screens maybe, but it's often a sign you're losing. I mean, I'm going to say two slightly contradictory points. The first is, I suppose, when you're looking at historic data, either ultimately there must be a point at which the context of the time is so different that it's almost irrelevant. I mean, I hear some Labour people talk about Harold Wilson, for example, but that was a pretty different time, different sort of demographic makeup, different type. What Labour meant at that time was completely different. And you could say the same about the Electoral College map and so on in the States. But there's one race, to completely contradict myself, that does stand out here for me that we haven't quite covered, which is 1956, which is Eisenhower's re-election. He goes in 7 points ahead after the conventions, and then he ends up winning by about 15-odd points. And I suppose the one scenario we haven't covered, the eventuality of, is that actually Hillary Clinton is, what do we say she was, 8 ahead?
Yep.
Ends up winning by 15, because actually it just gets worse and worse and worse for Donald Trump. And yeah, I guess we'll wait and see what happens. I suspect that won't happen just because she's relatively unpopular herself, right?
But I think the other interesting thing about 56, of course, is it's a rematch of 52. Adlai Stevenson was the candidate in 52, was re-elected by the Democrats to be their candidate in 56. So the extent to which you got, and admittedly, you know, everything, polling and electorals, you know, were different in the 50s, let's face it.
Yep.
But to get that much of a movement amongst two candidates who were well-known, you know, that essentially does control for lots of the factors that we're talking about in terms of known unknowns and unknown candidates emerging to the electorate and telling them something that they didn't know before. The fact that you do get an 8-point bump there suggests that stuff, whether it's the economy, foreign policy events, whatever else it might be, the kind of stuff that, you know, makes for a narrative in a campaign other than, you know, what the candidate says and who the candidate is, is, you know, potentially could have a big impact. And, you know, we still see the model floating around. I mean, a number of these states are really close, and it doesn't take much to nudge a fair few of them one way or the other, you know. Hillary Clinton could pick up Georgia and Missouri. You know, these are states which you would have never really thought of, certainly not when she was slugging it out with Bernie Sanders, that you thought she would be that likely to win. Similarly, like, you know, Florida on this projection almost looks safe, which I think anybody with any knowledge of Florida politics would
think is nuts. You know, just to reinforce Kieran's point, that I think on the 538 model, they have it about the same chance that Trump wins as Clinton wins by the kind of landslide that you've just talked about.
And also, of course, let's face it, the odds are not dissimilar to the odds of Brexit. You know, Trump winning is not dissimilar to the odds of Brexit on the eve of, you know, the referendum. So,
well, like we say, I mean, Hillary Clinton isn't such a perfect candidate that, you know, the tide can't turn. Let's turn our attention back to the UK for my topic. Now, Political Betting have had their first, or at least their first poll for a while with YouGov. I know it's a question that Mike quite enjoys, and I share that view. I think it's one I introduced at Comrades back in the day when I was there, which is looking at sort of favourability ratings of political parties and leaders. Not a new thing, quite common in the States, of course.
You know that at PSB, Kieran?
Quite common in American polling as well. But we've got the slide here, which looks at the net favourability rating, which is essentially subtracting those unfavourable from those that are favourable. Barack Obama there, overwhelmingly the most popular politician slash party on the list, plus 46. Theresa May, the most popular politician in Britain, or British politician, I should say, with a rating of plus 12. So reflecting, I think, what we were talking about earlier, is that her personal ratings are very strong. But there were two observations I had from this poll. The first is that the Conservative Party is Britain's most popular political party, which may not be necessarily shocking when you think about their, you know, position in the opinion polls, but I suppose the fact that the British public are more favourable to the Conservative Party than the Labour Party, you know, kind of undercuts a lot of what the left have tried to be about in the past, which is that we're the good guys, we've just got to be credible. Whereas actually, it seems that not only the Tories credible, they're, I don't know if good guys is the right phrase, but they're, people are more favourable towards them. And we've also got this age-old finding, which we haven't seen in polling form for a little while, but intuitively we know, which is that people are much more positive about their own local MP than MPs in general. So the net favourability rating for your MP is minus 2, and I think to bring some flesh to that, it was roughly a third favourable, a third unfavourable towards their sort of local MP.
Given that very few MPs win a plurality in their, sorry, win a majority in their constituency, makes total sense.
Yeah. But then when you look at sort of MPs, generally, I think it's minus 54 is the net favourability rating, which means that 7 in 10 have an unfavourable view of MPs generally. I mean, I just wanted to bring sort of zero in on that point, really. It just does sort of show, Leah, there's this distrust in politics generally, but there's our local guy or gal is really good.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think, you know, it's kind of finding that we broadly know about, and, you know, it sort of makes me very sympathetic to a lot of MPs who go out on tours saying, "Why do you all hate us?" and, you know, sort of do everything that they can to get those two closer together by and not just by punching lots of local voters till they're hated as well. I think it's a tough one, but I mean, the thing that really struck me about this was a sort of feeling about, you touched on the feeling of the views of the main parties. I mean, they're all pretty unpopular, and it feels to me like this is showing how much space there is in the centre ground of British politics. So a good chunk of Tory MPs, of Tory voters are unhappy with their party. So people who voted Tory in 2015, 17% of them are unfavourable with the Tories. Labour voters, it's even worse. A quarter of them are unfavourable with Labour. I think we've got to assume that those are Tory voters who supported Remain and Labour voters who don't like Corbyn, by and large. Mm. It feels like there's a lot of people from the main parties who are looking for a more centre-ground option. So who do they look for? Well, the Lib Dems are just as unpopular as anyone else. And Farron, he's doing pretty badly too. And what that's about when you dig into the numbers are the don't-knows, that essentially there's this vacuum in the centre that no one really has a sense that there's this party that is doing these things that they can consider.
Well, the example you've used there, though, feels to be around the Remain side of the spectrum, doesn't it? It feels like Labour supporters who maybe didn't like Jeremy Corbyn anyway, but their big gripe with him at the moment is that his apparent lacklustre campaign for Remain, whereas on the Conservative side there are these Tory voters that think that the country's made the wrong decision. But then how that actually manifests itself politically, it's hard to see, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's not a new observation to say that it's really hard for the Lib Dems to win in the centre, that it's much easier for them to win when they have a very distinctive position, normally to the left of Labour. Mm. Clearly, Farron has tried that with EU membership being their defining issue. That doesn't seem really to have cut through at all now. So even though the centre sort of feels like that's where there's not only, as you'd expect, the median voter, but also where there's lots of voters who are dissatisfied with their party. But this just goes to show how hard it is for them to cut through in that space.
I want to bring Rob in here. Rob, we were talking about this chart and some of the findings about it earlier today, weren't we? And one of the striking ones is that Vladimir Putin is more popular than Donald Trump. You were looking at some of the underlying numbers of that, weren't you?
And so there are four entities in this list which have a higher favourability amongst C2DE voters than amongst ABC1s. So they're not. That doesn't mean that they're positive amongst this group, but just that ABC, that C2DEs are rating them more highly than ABC1s. And, the tendency, part of that story is, C2DEs are more fed up with everybody in politics than everyone else, which, ties into a sort of a narrative about left behind. It also ties into the Your MP versus MPs generally and Theresa May versus, the government, which is individuals versus the system, right? You can run against the system, you can be fed up with everything, but elections aren't about that. They're about actually what you're going to they're also about what you're positively going to vote for. And so the sort of disconnect there is interesting, as is the fact that the four entities that get a higher rating amongst them are Boris Johnson, Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump and UKIP.
Yes.
And which is kind of like a sort of a narrative tale of sort of Western, Western European global politics in 2016, if you ask me, in terms of this great cleavage of anti-system left behind with a bit of a sprinkling of authoritarian foreign policy sort of thrown in for good measure.
Well, UKIP voters gave Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, I believe, higher favourability ratings than George Osborne and David Cameron.
Well, this is what I mean, but this is at least part of it, right? So obviously I don't know the answer to this. But my projection on that would be these are strong, well kind of established, clear what they stand for, no nonsense kind of things, clear what they're for, clear what they're against. You might not like it, they might not be, they might be a bit Marmite. They also are almost certainly what the kind of wine sipping cosmopolitans in London don't like, and therefore this is we might not like them, but we're for those guys and not against those guys, right?
And it just sort of makes me think, well, what does happen to them? So, as Kieran said, so a third, 31% of UKIP voters have a positive opinion of Trump. So it's still net negative, but where do those voters go? We haven't talked about it today, but we perhaps are beginning to see the demise of UKIP post-referendum, mm-hmm. leadership split, a bit of a crisis, Welsh AM defecting, what happens to them? And what happens to those voters, the 3 in 10 UKIP voters who are looking for a Trump figure?
Well, we're almost. UKIP is like Farage comes back in a year's time and saves the day.
He's growing a moustache, isn't he? So I think there's a cunning plan going there. So I've had to have a bit of a disguise.
Let's not get into comparisons with Oswald Mosley.
let's move on to our final topic. Last few minutes. A poll from YouGov recently, I think it was a couple of weeks old, on sort of whether past prime ministers were good or bad prime ministers. And again, you can look at this in a number of different ways, but there's the net sort of good versus poor rating, if you like. And the thing that struck me here was that when you rank David Cameron, Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, John Major, and Margaret Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher is overwhelmingly the most popular former Prime Minister of the recent past. 43% think she did a great or good job. She has a plus 13 net rating, meaning that 43% thought she did a great or good job versus 30% that thought she was poor or terrible. And, you know, can only in theory be a good thing for Theresa May if she is portraying this Iron Lady 2 sort of mantra, if you like. And if you look at some of the other prime ministers, David Cameron, for all his faults, and we just saw on that previous slide that, you know, his favourability ratings are pretty dire at the moment, he's on sort of minus two. So actually, he's seen as, if you like, the best prime minister since Margaret Thatcher. And I guess the final striking thing is that if you look at the two that stand out as particularly bad, it's Tony Blair on minus 28, 48% think he did a poor or terrible job, and Gordon Brown on minus 46, which means 55% thought he did a poor or terrible job. Seems like the Labour Party are in a bit of trouble here, doesn't it, chaps? Leo, what do you think?
So I think this is so interesting. It's one of those set of numbers that just really surprised me. So, I mean, a few things about it. I was absolutely taken aback that Thatcher's score is so positive. The only one with a net positive score. I mean, certainly, you know, I've sort of grown up in a culture and an environment where I haven't heard people generally saying positive things about her, and it's not something that I had expected and find surprising. But really, I think what's going on with the Labour scores as opposed to the Tory scores is, for all the Tories, the ex-prime ministers have a net favourable rating amongst Tory voters. For Labour, the ex-Labour prime ministers, they all have a negative rating amongst Labour voters. So somehow Labour are doing a much worse job, or just much less positive about their ex-prime minister than Tory voters are. I mean, the fact that Cameron has a plus 52 amongst Tory voters and Brown has a minus 25 among Labour voters is just so interesting.
Yeah, and it sort of talks to this idea of government being betrayal. What does it tell you? It certainly seems like, you know, as Leo was saying, the Labour Party in a bit of trouble there, but you know, Margaret Thatcher being the sort of the legacy of Thatcher seemingly positive, at least at the moment.
I mean, it's just bizarre, isn't it? I mean, at each phase, Prime Minister on the steps of Downing Street, triumphant flag waving, all behind them, you know, ding dong, you know, the previous guy's dead and we've taken over with each successive wave, and then it seems to get progressively worse in terms of the historical memory. But yeah, like Leo said, I mean, the fact that Labour voters rate John Major's prime ministership the same as Gordon Brown's. I mean, it's extraordinary. Mm. I mean, Gordon Brown, who was a Labour Chancellor for 10 years, and that basically spent those 10 years bit by bit undoing each and every political economic aspect of John Major's legacy. I mean, it's extraordinary.
And to be honest, another great surprise that Gordon Brown is less popular than Tony Blair. I mean, I wouldn't have got that at all. Well, amongst everyone, but also amongst Labour voters.
I mean, I wouldn't say I'm surprised by amongst everybody. I mean, he ultimately did.
I think Brown
won three elections.
Well, bizarrely, I think in the sort of, if you like, the Corbyn-induced fissure, I feel like Gordon Brown has been the biggest loser, because both sides in that kind of hate, you know, resent him, right? You've got the kind of ultra-Blair loyalists for whom, you know, Blair did no wrong, and then Brown started messing it all up, and you've got the Corbynistas who think that Brown is just as bad as Blair. Yeah. You know, the same people who think that Tom Watson's a Blairite. Right.
And one day we'll have to look at this in the context of Scotland again, because that's obviously a whole different sort of can of worms, if you like. But that's all we've got time for this week. Leo and Rob, thank you very much for your contributions today. That is all we've got time for this week's Political Betting Polling Matters show. Stay tuned. In the coming weeks, we'll be looking at events across the pond and looking ahead to the party conference season.
You've been listening to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast, which is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top podcast app around. You can get instant updates of your new favourite podcasts directly to your Podbean podcast app. It's free, easy to use, and lets you easily discover new podcasts that you love and also publish your own podcast too. Whether you use an Android device or an iPhone device, this app is the app for you. So get the new Podbean podcast app today on Google Play or Apple App Store. Enjoy more from the podcasts that you love.